This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 398 for November 3 of 2017. Sales still rocking, Tesla dropping, and V2V vanishing? Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Mr. Gary Vasilash, we got another show on our hands today.
We do. I feel a little odd, though. This is the first time in a long time we have a car in the studio, but I think we've made up for it by having these two guys here. A
couple of car guys, yeah. And we should let everybody know we got Jake Holmes from Motor One. Great to have you here on the show, Jake.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Paul Eisenstein with the Detroit Bureau. And great having you here, Paul.
Great to be back with you, John.
Yeah. So, Gary, I know you always pick a number of topics you think we ought to get into. And on today's show, this is going to be a wide-ranging debate. Like you said, we don't have a car. We don't have a special guest from one of the car companies or the like. So we're going to let it.
We got these highly knowledgeable guys. And for people who are not familiar with Motor One, you guys are a website that covers all things automobile.
Everything automobile is the hope, from news, reviews, a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Okay. So we got it sort of squared away there. We know what these guys are all about. I mean, Paul knows everything. We had sales, okay?
October sales. Just came in.
We'll start with you, Paul. What's your take on how they did?
There's a couple of assumptions you have to question. Why did they do so well? It was a great month. I mean, after watching the industry seemingly spiral worse and worse and worse, suddenly we got great numbers in September and even better numbers in October. The big question is, will it be sustainable, or was this a peculiar thing that came out of the hurricane? Mm-hmm. Remember what they said, 500,000 vehicles destroyed in Texas alone, and then you had Florida and Puerto Rico was probably not going to measure anywhere. But will it be sustainable, or is it a one-month or two-month hit that will then vanish? Then the other question is, what do you read into the numbers? Because there are some real interesting things happening, in particular, the collapse, and it's virtually a collapse of the luxury side of the market.
Yeah. Jake, right. What do you? Well, let's get Jake in on it.
I agree. I was expecting probably worse numbers than I saw, actually. And so I was pleasantly surprised by how they were. But yeah, I saw a lot of struggles on the luxury side. And as we've come to expect, a lot of big successes from SUVs and trucks right across the line. It seems like if you want to sell right now, you have to be selling SUVs, and don't put your hopes in your sedans anymore.
Well, not so much SUVs. It's crossovers. John, we spoke a little bit about this before the show. But that's the interesting thing, is basically designers have been told, just go and have fun. Design stuff that doesn't fall into any real category anymore. Yeah. And consumers have responded. They like the idea that there is quite literally something for everybody's tastes and need out there. I grew up where there were very, very narrow formulas. And if you were lucky, it was a little bit of difference in the bending of the sheet metal, but not much else. Now, it's pretty much everything goes. And I think the consumers in the U.S. are really resonating with that.
Well, Gary, what's your takeaway?
Well, I mean, I agree with all that has been said. Okay, I think that
we can leave?
Yeah, we'll see you guys later. So I think we're still dealing with a hurricane, because it seems to me that last month, I mean, how many people really got the insurance checks to be able to go out and get a new car? So I think that was an element why we had this in October. I think that, you know, we continue to see the strength in the crossover segment. And I'm not with you in terms of seeing these things being very bizarrely shaped or different. I mean, because if I look at the numbers here, I see that the best-selling light vehicle that isn't a Ford F-Series pickup truck is basically the Toyota RAV4. I mean, and the Toyota RAV4 has basically been the RAV4 since the RAV4 has been the RAV4. right? I mean, it's fair. And, you know, and so that came in at 34,000.
Wait a minute. Can I quote you on that? The RAV4 has been the RAV4 since it's been the RAV. Okay, I just wanted to get that straight.
I left my notebook in the other room, but
I'll remember that. And then the thing that really struck me, though, I mean, the whole thing about the luxury market, and this is very, very peculiar, I thought. And there was a great quote from Tom Libby, who works for IHS Market, mm-hmm. and we've had Stephanie on the show, and from IHS, and he says, currently 16 brands are competing in the exceptionally competitive luxury space, which accounts for just about 12% of the market, and most of these marques continue to expand their product portfolio by adding all new products or derivatives of existing models. With so many brands and models targeting a limited population, it is not surprising that several luxury marques, including Lexus, Infiniti, Acura, Lincoln, and Cadillac, I mean, like, who's left, saw sales declines in October.
Yeah.
I mean, so are these guys all fighting for a shrinking pie that isn't very delicious anymore?
Yeah, and a couple of things, Gary. Number one, you know that there's, I believe, only one dealer in the world that carries all of the Mercedes products. There are so many of them now. And that's something like a dealership in Dubai, if I remember correctly. You can't have them. People can't figure out what to get. So I think product confusion is the case. On the other hand, an interesting point that you raised, and it gets back to my point about something for everybody, there's still a handful of high-volume models. And the RAV4, as you know, is becoming the number one product, not the Camry anymore, for Toyota.
Right.
But if you look, it's a fragmented market. When all of us were starting, if you sold less than 200,000 of a particular vehicle, it was considered a failure. These days, you can sell, in some cases, 5 or 10,000 units of a particular vehicle, and it's considered a success.
My takeaway, sticking with the RAV4 for the moment, is the RAV4 hybrid almost caught up to the Prius in sales.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think there's two things going on there. Prius sales continue to nosedive.
Right.
And that RAV4 hybrid is red hot mm-hmm. as far as hybrids go. You know, there's still a small slice of the market, but that number jumped out at me.
Mm-hmm. And they're going to be coming out with a new RAV4 that'll have a lower price point, so hybrid, so they'll even do better on that.
Yeah.
And but yeah, I mean, you look at the I mean, so the Civic came in at 30,000, and the RAV4 came at 34. Nissan Rogue that we talked about that some months ago. I mean, that's still doing very well. I mean, they've sold 327,000 of those
far
this year. And, you know, and on it goes. And the Accord in October outsold the Camry, and the Civic outsold both of those.
Now, there's another thing going on.
We may see the Camry being unseated this year for the first time in terms of car, not in terms of RAV4.
There's another curious thing happening, and this is very difficult for a lot of folks to digest. I mean, I'm still not sure I have my head around it, is that we're seeing a lot of repositioning by the automakers. So, for example, the big three have been slashing, particularly Ford and GM, slashing their dependence on fleet. Daily rentals in particular. And we're seeing other manufacturers that traditionally laughed at them for being so heavily based in fleet getting into fleet in a big way. Toyota is becoming one of the biggest spenders on incentives and one of the biggest investors in the fleet market. So I don't know. Is that a good thing or bad? Because they used to laugh at the way that the Detroit makers propped up sales. And now it's the Japanese, in many cases,
they're doing exactly the
same thing.
No, I would say Nissan, Hyundai, Mazda probably have a bigger push into fleet than Toyota. But, yeah, Toyota, which sneered at fleet sales in the past, is stepping that up.
Only Honda's remain true to its foundation on that.
I agree. Hey, we got a question from a viewer while we're in on this. Chevrolet Bolt sales did pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And so Breon Bowser wrote in to ask, is the Bolt sales success actually good for GM? Well, yeah, I don't know how it could be bad for GM.
They'll lose
it as a positive.
They lose money.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. If they lose money, you'd say that's a bad thing. But I think it's a good thing.
Yes.
Because if General Motors / Chevrolet gets associated in people's minds
with green and electric,
or with advanced technology. I mean, let's just just put it out there that way. I mean, when did you ever think advanced technology in General Motors? I mean, I know that
But it's definitely a positive for the brand image, I think, to have very eco-friendly, modern electric cars running around with a Chevy badge on the front. Mm-hmm. I think
it's great. It's also showing something very interesting because they blew Tesla out of the water last month. Now, of course, Tesla can't build their Model 3, which was, to me, one of the biggest stories of the week, listening to Elon Musk fluff and just struggle to deal with the news that he had a delivery yesterday when he had a cold. Yeah. He also had a panic attack. If you listen to him, he was definitely flustered. And it was a very telling situation. They blew it. They blew it badly. They promised, overpromised as typical.
The stock is still very high, still over 300, but way down from what it was just recently.
The stock will be high if they declare bankruptcy.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, let's touch on that for a minute. I mean, I would think that, so what, it was $615 million loss in the third quarter?
910, I thought.
Whatever. They lost.
They lost a lot of
hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Millions of
dollars. Or hundreds of millions, excuse
me. Right. Okay. So, and to your point, Paul, I mean, in this Model 3 launch, and also, John, you mentioned that, and, you know, I was reading their letter to the shareholder sort of thing, and they're talking about, you know, we had bursts of volumes of 1,000 vehicles. Okay, bursts. So I basically figure that what they did was they ran the line a little bit and then calculated, okay, if it took us this long and we built this many cars, we could extrapolate and be 1,000, right? But, I mean, if you look at final assembly, we had bursts of 500.
Because they've delivered fewer than 500 cars total.
I mean, think about this.
To employees.
Mainly to employees, yeah.
And they've got reservations for 500,000 cars.
Right.
Right? So how long... If they're building, let's give them the 1,000. Let's say the burst is sustainable, right? So in 52 weeks, how many cars will they build? 52,000, which is basically a tenth of what they have. I think this is it for those. I think.
And how many reservation holders give up and go buy a Chevy Volt instead? Yeah. Bolt, sorry. Instead.
Chevy Bolt. I think that's happening already.
Yeah. And that's why
you're starting to see people do that. That news conference was very telling. In fact, he borrowed a certain management style, a PR style, if you will, from a certain person in a house colored white in Washington, taking an assault on the media for what he said was our incorrect coverage of the firing of, 700 workers. It was the first time I've heard Musk take that approach to basically say we all blew the coverage. But he's got trouble in a lot of different places. Right. And the most important thing that we have to be watching is, can they fix this? They claimed that it was a supplier who blew the programming in zone one of four zones.
But this is in the battery plant, not in the production plant.
Across the board, they've made all sorts of problems. And the question is, will they be able to get this fixed, and will they be able to afford the second part of their assembly line? And that's a major problem, because if they cannot afford that, they may have to go back to stockholders, and they may not get as good a reception doing that yet again.
Well, you know, the thing I wonder about is that, okay, this industry is not standing still. I mean, in every single automobile manufacturer is working hard at bringing out fully electric vehicles or electrified vehicles, right?
Right.
And so, you know, we're going to begin to see choice. I mean, so when is the Mission E, the Porsche, supposed to come out?
Next year.
But there's a new Nissan Leaf coming in a couple of months' time, which would be priced really, really competitively. Mm-hmm. That I could see tearing away people who had been waiting on the Model 3.
Right.
And maybe it's already happening with the Bolt EV, like you said. So there's a lot of competition to Model 3.
You've got 20, at least 20, long-range electric vehicles due by 2020.
Right. So the question then becomes, I mean, 2020 is not that long from now. And so even if they get this thing running, I mean, is it going to be too little too late?
You know, I think Tesla has a history of under delivering and over promising.
Right.
This is another example of it. So if he's up to line speed July next year, I think he's good to go.
You think people will tolerate that?
There will be enough who will... They'll lose people who would put the deposit down. They'll lose a bunch of them. But there'll be enough there to go, hey, look, boom. We're hitting our line rate.
He won't be.
Well, we'll see.
No, I'll tell you why. Because right now, they are not spending. They said during the news conference, they are not going to spend right now on expanding the line so they can hit the 10,000 a week target that they said. And whenever they do spend the money, it's going to take a time to validate. And they've got to make sure that they don't make the errors that they did already. So it could take them a year or more
before they're ready. This is the most absurd, to your point, Paul, this is the most absurd line I've ever read, perhaps ever, in the auto industry. Quote, "With respect to the timing for producing 10,000 units per week, it has always been our intention to implement that capacity after we've achieved a 5,000 per week runway rate." Really? You know, and I bet you, like, 5,001, they'd have to wait till they had 5,002.
To me, the stupidest line...
It makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
The stupidest line that Musk came up with was talking about, in some parts of manufacturing, we're hitting a run rate of 5,000 a week, 7,000 a week. And, Gary, you know manufacturing. Your assembly line can only move as fast as your slowest station.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so if you can make 7,000 a week over here, but you're only building
12
a day, right?
Right.
It doesn't matter that you can make 7,000 over here. That's total overproduction.
Right. So if they have this burst capacity of 1,000 units in stamping, but they have the weld capacity of 500 units in the burst capacity, seems to me we have large piles of stampings that are piling up all over the factory.
I
just think this is it for him.
Can I tell you the real measure? This is the thing that will determine whether or not they make it. What has Tesla's biggest problem been to date? Quality.
Well, there's that, too.
Okay. Yeah. And they have been appealing, they've been selling to true believers who are willing to put up with a week out without a car, because they probably have three or four others besides a Model S or Model X. Well, the reality is Model 3 owners are more likely to have Model 3. And if those vehicles go out and they may have to truck them across the state or even to the next state to get them, they're not going to put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot have the problem that they have with a Model S today, never mind Model X. And remember, Model X was just declared by Consumer Reports tied as the worst vehicle on the road, along with, sadly, the Cadillac Escalade.
Right. Okay, we've beat Tesla into the ground. Here's a comment from Jonathan Brown, going back to our earlier conversation on crossovers. He says, ownership is longer and CUVs date slowest, meaning they keep the owners in style or contemporary longest. That's not a bad observation. Mm-hmm. Sedans, maybe we're just more used to looking at sedans,
yeah,
but the styling on CUVs tends to hold longer better. He may have a good observation there.
Mm-hmm. I think you could make an argument they last through more stages of your life as well. If you buy a CUV when you're young and then have a family or dogs or whatever, you can adapt and keep using that vehicle. If you have a two-door coupe and suddenly have a family, it might not be so flexible to keep it so long.
Good point. Good point. Yeah.
You know, to get back to mentioning the Escalade, is anything going to pull Cadillac out of its doldrums?
What do you think, Jake?
Good question.
That was a large...
China?
Well, China's doing it. But I think Gary's asking here in the U.S. market.
Yeah, I know what you're asking.
That's a great question. I think we've seen a couple of years of strong designs and pretty good cars from Cadillac, and so I'm not sure what it takes to get that message from people like us to consumers.
Well, hold on, because read off the percentage decline in Cadillac's sedans.
So
ATS is down how much?
So for the month or for the year?
For the month.
Okay, so for the month of October, ATS down 41.7.
41% CTS.
CTS down 23.9.
Wow.
And that isn't from a very big number either.
Right.
Well,
CT6, 39.5.
39. This is a brand new car. And
well,
XTS.
What is the S-Class on?
XTS...
What's up?
The true Cadillac.
What's up, right?
Up 19.5%.
I think the market is telling Cadillac, and its SUVs and crossovers are doing just fine.
Right. But that's the problem. They don't have
enough.
They don't have the SUVs.
But what I'm
CUVs
saying is the market, and look, we can pick BMW apart, doing the same kind of analysis on it.
BMW number.
Get out of cars.
Yeah.
The market, unless It's a traditional XTS, which Cadillac would love to get rid of, and it's the best-selling car they've got. Car, not SUV, CUV.
But that's
best-selling
the
car they got, the one that they are trying to put a stake in. Look, you got to listen to the market. And
should
the market
they bring back the old Fleetwood?
Yes.
Well, I mean, isn't this sort of the point, we've talked about this before, is that basically, I mean, you know, you look at the Continental. The Continental is had no pretensions of being a BMW fighter, right? It was meant to be a DeVille.
Yeah.
Right? And now they didn't do so well this past month, but for the year, for the year, they're doing very well. And
it's not a direct competitor to CT6, would you say? A little less aspirational.
Continental?
Yeah.
You get the black label Continental, load that baby up, you're good to go.
Massaging seats and all that stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right.
You know the puzzling thing about maybe you guys have noticed this in driving those Lincolns with the powered seat that goes every which way. There should be like a reset button that takes you back to zero.
I totally agree. I think the more options you have for moving the seats, the less comfortable you get. The more uncomfortable positions you can find.
Right. You're like completely contorted, and you're just like, damn it, I've got to.
Because you have so many infinite, adjustments.
Right.
It's like, oh, now I can adjust a little bit more, but you're never satisfied.
If I can only move it in four ways, then I can easily find a position. But
right.
30 ways?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so basically your left leg is shorter than your right leg and, higher. And
I can think of the icon that they would use. Would be a pretzel with a slash through it.
Yeah. There we go.
Okay, we've got another question here, but we're not going to answer it yet because Matt, the viewer, wants to know, any remarks regarding Trump canceling the V2V mandate? And yes, we're going to talk a lot about that.
Oh,
but first, we're going to take a commercial break. We're going to come out of that and talk to Dr. Data. But right now, a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Autoline After Hours, and it is time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so this one is going to be somewhat, it's a traditional Dr. Data, so I'm going to provide a number, actually a set of numbers here, and I want you guys to identify what those numbers represent.
Whoa.
Okay, and so, Carmen, please bring the first slide up. So 3 years, 9,000, 6 years, 7,000. And John, for your benefit, I didn't know this. I had to ask back in the control room, but actually that spectral ghost-like thing in the back is actually...
It's a giveaway.
It's a giveaway, yeah.
See, because, I always try to guess what the numbers are. Sometimes I get it. I don't get this at all. It looks like some sort of yellow light.
Okay, but so you're not...
It's the decline in light output of headlights.
No. But
my guess, too.
Sometimes we talk about the pollution in Paris. And you'll see the Eiffel Tower, and then you'll say, "Oh, that's pollution in Paris, or whatever." But that provides no information, whatever. I mean, I know what it is, and I can't even see it.
So it says 3 years equals 9,000, and the line below it says 6 years equals 7,000, and I have no idea what that means.
Jake,
I got nothing. I don't know where you're going with this,
Paul.
Okay, Dr.
All right.
Data.
All right, so before I give this away, what we did was on the website, autoline.tv, we ran a poll, and we asked people to give their answers, and so we gave them four choices, okay? So 8% thought that the 9,000, so we just gave them the 9,000. So 8% thought that the 9,000 was the amount of time it takes to drive 9,000 miles
in a golf cart.
19% thought it was how long it would take Elon Musk to build 9,000 miles of his tunnel. 15% thought it would take 3 years to build a certain kind of a Lamborghini. And 58% thought it would be that it would take 3 years to recycle 9,000 Chevy Bolt batteries. So 58%. So
is one of those the right answer?
Sort of, yes.
Okay,
so bring up the next slide, please. So the 9,000 is
what?
That it basically took Lamborghini. Let's get this right here now. So blah, 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 blah. 6 years to build these cars. So
he's not sure of this.
No. Well, it's because I'm okay. So it was because I got these things. Right, 3 years, 9,000 miles. So it was the Huracan, which cost $200,000. It took them 6 years to build.
9,000 of them.
9,000 of them.
Oh,
and
okay.
7,000, next one.
Aventadors.
3 years.
Huh.
So Aventador is selling better, is what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that a lot of people apparently have $4,000 or $400,000 to spend on a car.
Hmm.
So actually, if we look at these numbers, so, you know, if you have 7,000 and 9,000 produced in 6 and 3 years, respectively, that maybe Elon Musk is doing all right. Maybe I'm all wrong.
Maybe.
He's not selling his cars for quite this much, though.
That's a very good point.
No, but if you look at it, he is outselling, if I remember correctly, even though it was not good last month, the numbers for the Model S were greater than all the luxury sedans from competitors, including the S-Class, the A8, the 7 Series, and anything else you want to throw in there. So from that sense, he's still doing all right in the high-end market.
Right. So let's not beat on him, but let's go to that question again, John.
Matt, the viewer, wanted to know, do we have anything to say about Trump canceling the V2V mandate? Paul, I know since he's your most favorite president of all time, you want to weigh in on this.
Oh, boy.
It would surprise me he has an opinion on this. I just can't imagine this would be the...
You can tell by me turning red at the idea you would even say that. I think it is one of the most absurd moves I've seen because nobody except the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which would oppose the government intervening to save a drowning child, seems to be supporting this decision. The automakers want V2V in part because they need that technology for the autonomous vehicle development.
So explain to the audience who don't know what V2V is, what it is.
For those who don't know it, V2V is vehicle-to-vehicle technology. It's communication system. There's also V2I, which means vehicle-to-infrastructure, and generically they use the term V2X, which means, you know, all of this.
Don't confuse it. Let's just talk V2V.
So vehicle to vehicle is my car talking to your car, talking to John's car, talking to
John's car. We're driving down the road. My car is alerted when there's a traffic jam, a crash, bad weather. You're heading towards a light, and somebody in another car runs it. My car will get an alert, and in more advanced systems, might actually apply the brake automatically in time, before I even realize there's something going on, to avoid that accident.
Okay, and so what was canceled?
What they apparently are doing is canceling a mandate that would have within, what was it, John, 18 months.
2021, I thought.
Yeah, it was basically as soon
there was
as...
A phase-in.
Right, 50% of all new vehicles built starting 18 months out, I believe, from the effective date of the mandate would have to have vehicle-to-vehicle technology. 3 years, I believe, it went to 100%. Automakers say that technology is critical towards tomorrow's autonomous vehicles. And here's where it gets a total disconnect. The White House wants to cancel V2V just because it's a mandate. Congress is running around right now trying to put in place all sorts of new rules to promote the technology that needs the V2V technology to work. Explain that to me. It doesn't make any sense.
So what, I mean, okay, if I'm General Motors and I think this is good stuff, why don't I just put it in my cars?
You got to have standards.
Well, Cadillac's already got it.
But I mean, why would you standardize it for one thing?
You need infrastructure because it's not just my car talking to yours, but it's also you guys are the infrastructure. You also have to participate in the communication. There's also issues going on with the spectrum. There's a debate going on. The only people that really seem to be happy about this are in the telecommunications industry because they wanted the same spectrum. And the FCC has been trying to figure out a way to let them both use a spectrum at the same time. It just makes no sense. The industry wants to go about doing this, and Congress, you would think, would be saying, wait a second, we need that technology for the rules we're trying to put in place to put more autonomous vehicles on the road.
Jake, what do you think?
I mean, you're right. Some car companies are developing their own, right? Cadillac has, and Audi has their own systems, and
Toyota.
Audi can talk to traffic lights in Las Vegas and things, but certain places and only certain cars. The whole point of this was to have every car on the road, and the study I saw said that they thought it would only cost a couple of $100 per new car to install this technology, could prevent a lot of crashes, even on human-driven cars, and it seems to me like a huge step backward to not add this technology. But like Paul said, the telecom companies really wanted that same frequency spectrum. They wanted to use it for cell phones and cable TV and so on. And I wonder if that's a little bit of why V2V cars lost out.
I don't think that's the case. I mean, look, the Trump administration says it wants to get rid of regulations.
Yeah.
And here's a new NHTSA regulation, and they'll just like, just kill the thing. And, you know, according to NHTSA or the DOT, it would add about $320 to $350 cost to the car. In this industry, that's a lot of money, you know, if nobody else is doing it. If everyone's doing it, fine. You know, we all eat the cost, we raise the price by that much, and we're good to go. To me, though, this is the most significant safety technology since the seatbelt, way better than the airbag. This can prevent cars from crashing into each other. And as you were talking about, Paul, it can see around corners. Places you cannot see, V2V can see around what's going on.
Laser, radar, LIDAR.
No,
none of that can do
none
that.
None of that can
what
do that.
Can
no,
do
no,
this.
I see what you're going. Right, yeah. So to me, this is the most significant technology anyway. I thought I saw a statement by Mary Barra saying, we're going to go around Congress and try to get this reinstated.
Yeah.
And, you know, GM has been out in the forefront. Cadillac was the first to offer it. But you're right, you know.
We've seen before that mandating safety systems is the way to go. You know,
it is.
Stability control and tire pressure monitoring.
Exactly right.
There was a safety benefit. It was mandated. And then, like you say, there was no cost advantage from one manufacturer or another. Everyone had to have it.
But
and
you,
I think that should have been the
case. Do you remember
here.
Something that happened? Sorry, Jake, I'm going to step on you. Do you remember what happened just before the end of the Obama administration? You saw the industry come together with NHTSA under Mark Roskind and say that they would form a series of consortia aimed at uniformly developing new safety technologies, trying to drive it in across the industry, one, to get it out in large numbers, but two, to also drive down costs. And this is one of the technologies that they were all in favor of. It strikes me as bizarre for the White House to be trying to get rid of a technology, a mandate, that the industry, normally averse to government reg, is calling for.
Right. Yep. And maybe, hopefully, with what Mary Barra said, if I got that right, there will be a push to say, hey, this is one regulation we really welcome.
Yeah.
Well, while we got Paul talking about the president, what's your take on NAFTA?
I don't disagree that any trade mandate should be looked at. All countries involved should be looking and considering updates as they go along. The approach, this heavy-handed approach, and particularly for the president to be stepping in and going public and interfering with the actions of his trade negotiators, threatening to get rid of it and so on, I think is, again, heavy-handed, ill-conceived, and ultimately quite dangerous to not just NAFTA, but to the country as well.
I thought it was very surprising that the auto industry has come out and said, hey, leave it alone.
Oh yeah, look.
It's like they're saying it's okay. You know, I mean, yeah. don't
don't
mess with
the boat.
Don't mess
yeah.
with success.
Right, right. And look, the supply chain in North America is the best in the world right now. I would argue, certainly right up there with the best in the world. But I would argue it's the best in the world. Don't screw it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's
now there is one thing.
Yeah.
Mexican wages are way too low. To me, it is disgusting that a company like BMW is paying its new hires $1.10 an hour to assemble $45,000 vehicles.
Agreed.
To me, that is beyond stupid. And why Mexico lets them get away with this is bad. And people tell me, well, you got to understand the cost of living is less there. $1.10 an hour turns into an annual wage of $2,500.
Yeah.
That's what it's worth. And this is a country with a per capita income of $19,000. Now, in the United States, the average worker makes about $56,000, not including benefits. That's exactly what the per capita income is.
Yeah.
So at the very least, Mexican auto workers should be making $19,000 an hour, which, by the way, is about $9 an hour. So instead of paying them $1.10 an hour like BMW is, they should be paying them $9 an hour.
The fact that they're paying them bare subsistence wages, barely subsistence wages, is just, it's criminal.
But that has nothing to do with NAFTA, though.
Well, it does. It does.
Could.
Because this is one of the reasons.
Can you mandate what wages are?
Well, what you can mandate is that you don't have these sham unions that are in bed with the car company and the local governor, who all they care about is a new plant comes in and they get a bunch of money on the side. Mm-hmm. That's what you can argue with in the NAFTA agreement, is that, no, you got to put teeth into your labor negotiations and you can't have these sweetheart deals being made.
Which is why I said that some revisions may be called for at times. To go back and renegotiate, to challenge certain assumptions and certain bad behaviors, you do have to work that into any trade organization and trade treaty. But what we're doing is just not being handled very well. By the way, one of the interesting things that I think a lot of people need to understand is there's another reason why Mexico is doing so well. And that has nothing to do with wages, or secondarily. And that is the fact that Mexico has more free trade agreements negotiated than any other country. And Dr. Data, can you tell me what the country that has more free trade agreements than Mexico is?
China?
Israel.
Oh.
That's the only other country with more. And so, China's as Audi has with the new Q5, a lot of people want to use Mexico as a global base, because they can ship it all over the world and have minimal to no tariffs.
What is BMW building there?
God, I wish I could tell you right off the top of my head. It is, I want to say, the X5?
No.
Somebody look it up and tell the chat room what they make in Mexico.
I don't know.
Let's say it's the whatever series, okay? So then couldn't BMW basically say to the United States, if the United States tried to say, hey, you've got to do what you're saying, you know, have the labor unions be legitimate, blah, 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 blah. They, you know what? We're just not going to sell you that car. We're going to just sell them the rest of the world.
Okay. Be my guest. Drop out of the richest, largest SUV market in the world.
But the SUVs, it's not an SUV. We know that for sure. So all the SUVs are out of Spartanburg.
Right. Okay, you're right.
That's a global thing. So my point is that so we've seen so many car companies build factories down there, and building factories down there because they basically looked at it and said, this is economical for us to be able to build here because of wages and, you know, incentives or whatever else, right? I mean, so you've got, you know, Nissan's got a giant plant there, Mercedes, Infiniti, Audi, the big three, you know, you name it, right?
I mean, everybody's there.
Everybody's there. And so basically it's just like, don't they sort of have some advantage? I mean, the company's not the country of Mexico, to make decisions to say, you know what, as you know, we were talking about China and Cadillac. I mean, so basically the China market is huge. Just sell there.
Yeah, but you're not going to be able to, because you're going to get slapped with a 25% import tariff that's going to make up all the savings that you've got in Mexico. And if you look at exports out of Mexico, I want to say about 60% of that production goes to the U.S.,
60%. Yeah, it's very large.
Giving up on the U.S. is giving up on a lot of volume.
Yeah. Here's the other weird thing about it, though, and it seems short-sighted in the long run. As Henry Ford taught us, and as China is now teaching us, one of the best ways to kickstart your economy is to what? You pay your workers in auto plants very well. They go out and buy your own cars. The Mexican auto industry, what is it, one-tenth the size of our auto industry per capita? Somewhere in that neighborhood. It's a very small market when it comes to buying cars. It's an extremely top-tier country when it comes to building cars.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you know, Mexico's got a population of over 100 million.
It's 150 now, John.
It's over 100 for sure. Canada has a population of, I want to say, about 35 million.
Right.
They both sell about the same number of vehicles.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Gary, we're coming up on a break. Should we just take a break now, or do you got something?
This will be quick.
Okay.
So we're talking about China. Okay, so this is a bizarre number, and I want somebody to explain to me what this is. Okay, so I was looking at the light vehicle sales. Okay, so this is through September, 17,583,000 vehicles, right? Production, 16,972,000. So there's a delta of 611,000 units, meaning 3.5% of their cars must be imported. 3.5%. What do we have, like 50% imported? Built by?
No, wait. Are you talking imported or coming from foreign-based manufacturers?
Foreign-based.
Well, foreign-based manufacturers, it's well into the majority now, but the vast majority of those are built in the United States, okay. Assembled in the U.S.
So what would 3.5% of the Chinese market be not built in China?
Luxury. Yeah, luxury stuff.
Specialty.
Look, you know, the Germans especially.
F-150.
And Cadillac made a bunch of money exporting cars to China. If you export cars to China, you don't have to share the profits with your joint venture partner. Now, you do get hit by the 25% import tariff. But if you're bringing in an AMG GT, the Chinese will snap it up all day long. And so you get all the profit. You know, you got to take off 25% tariff, give that to the government, but you keep all the profit. And so on high-line cars, there's still imports coming in where that customer in China says, I don't care about the tariff, just give me the damn car.
Yeah, I guess even a BMW X6 or something being exported from South Carolina over there would make up part of that, yeah. Hmm. And yeah, like you say, there's a tariff, but that customer can afford it in that situation.
Yep.
Expensive cars are the way to go.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a break right now. We've got to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to get to a bunch of rapid-fire questions right now. Dan the Man says, the next 3 Series will be built in Mexico. But that's on the BMW side. Let's see. There were a couple of questions here that I thought were pretty good. Oh, George from Sunnyvale wants to know, how do you move an autonomous car with no steering wheel and pedals onto a truck or a ship for transport? This would include getting it in position to tie it down. If it takes slower, will not transport costs go up?
Just put it on a pallet.
I guess you could have some sort of remote control system, right? Drive it from outside of the car with the joystick. But that is a great question. I think no one's gotten to that point yet.
Remember that Ford came up with recently with a technology, a patent, that they can have a steering wheel either pop out or they could stick a steering wheel in.
Well, this guy's saying, you know, he's talking level 5. No steering
wheel. But I'm talking about that.
Even
on some of those vehicles, you may wind up having either some sort of remote control, little joystick you can operate, or you may have an actual panel that might...
They're going to be able to go park themselves.
Well, that's
Audi's already demonstrated that, where you get out of a car, you hit the button, go park yourself, it drives into a parking structure, finds an open spot, and backs into it.
That's assuming these cars are power. They have power.
Well, how else are you going to get them on a truck? I mean, either somebody's gets in the car and drives
it. You're right. So, look.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Autonomous cars will get on the trailer. They'll get on the ship. No problem. In fact, right now, you've got to leave enough door space if you're putting a car on a ship for the driver to get out.
Oh.
Theoretically, you could park them right next to each other if no driver's getting out. You could put more cars on a ship.
And you might be able to get them on and off quicker if you don't have people running back to get the next car and drive it on.
Because if you've ever seen, I've never been and seen it, but I've seen videos. And it's a fire drill of people running back and forth all the time. So, autonomous cars, no issue with that. Okay, I'm going to throw this one to you, Jake, because here's a guy that wrote in to want to know, why is the U.S. spec Ford EcoSport 200 pounds heavier than where it's sold elsewhere? And he says he's not surprised that the EPA fuel economy numbers are lower than key competitors. I don't know is that the EPA numbers have been released on the EcoSport.
I didn't think they had been. But we've seen this a lot when cars have come from other markets, especially Europe, and the EcoSport's built in India to be imported here, that a lot of times to meet our really tough crash regulations, right, there's a lot of reinforcement built in. But also we often tend to have more highly contented cars. Sometimes, you know, European markets or Asian markets might accept cars with less content. And I know on the EcoSport they're going to put a lot of features in and options. exceptional sound system and things. So mm-hmm. I would guess that those two things together combine to probably bring the weight up by a couple hundred pounds. But yeah, I haven't seen specific fuel economy figures yet.
No.
Comfortable seats.
Frank Reed wants to know, or says, Cadillac's problem is their interiors. The cars drive well and look good, but compared to their competitors in each segment, they are second rate, especially the ATS. Mm-hmm. You agree the interiors are not good?
Their interiors are not up to, say, an Audi standard. Maybe BMW, which has never been as fancy inside. I think they could upgrade a little bit. I don't think that's the only reason, but I think it's one of them, and part of it is also reputation.
What do you think about their interiors, Jake?
I like the interior styling. I mean, I agree with Paul. I don't think they're maybe at the top-tier level we might see in, like, an Audi or Mercedes. I think maybe a bigger issue is the space in the interior. I know when I look in the back seat of an ATS or CTS, it's not as big as in the back of a German car or an Lexus that's in the same class. Maybe not the 3 Series.
BMW's always had that small back seat problem.
That's true. But I wouldn't say universally that I dislike Cadillac interiors.
Yeah, I
didn't say I dislike them. I don't think that they're necessarily... Mark Royce likes to say we no longer accept good enough or competitive. And I think Cadillac needs to, and Lincoln needs to, jump another hoop. They've got to take things to the point where when you get into their cars, you go, wow, I can't believe this is a competitor to... And you look down on the Germans or Japanese or British.
In the new Navigator, I was very surprised at the interior. I mean, it's like, wow, this is...
Yeah,
this
the Navigator is a good example.
It's really nice. And I think with Cadillac, part of the problem is that there is some parts sharing with other GM products. And I
look Tahoe, at, Silverado.
And I look at some of the knobs and switches, and I just think, you know what, this isn't Cadillac. And, a lot of the trim ought to be Cadillac exclusive, but it doesn't seem to be.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike from San Francisco wants to know, should the next EV from General Motors be a sedan, or should it be an all-wheel drive CUV?
CUV.
That answers itself, doesn't
it? Yeah. Right. We've been talking about the death of sedans
and
all along.
And let's add a little bit more. They need to boost the performance even higher. They need to really make it a standout. The Bolt is a fun car to drive, but it's not a standout in pretty much any way. It's really good, but I'd like to see something that I can throw a switch and really just my neck snaps like it does in some Tesla models, that the interior just gets up to the level that I go, wow.
So should the Bolt have been a Buick or something? I mean, there's always that argument that the ELR should have come out before the Volt, and that it would be the technological tour de force, and then we're going to make it available to the masses. Wouldn't it be the same thing with the Bolt? Say, you know what, we've got this
people are already criticizing how much the Bolt costs, right, and saying it's too expensive for an electric car. I think then if it was a Buick and it were more expensive, you'd have that same issue. I think that, I don't know if people want a luxurious EV, but I do think that an all-wheel drive crossover makes all the sense in the world. Everyone I talk to wants all-wheel drive. Even if they live in California or Florida, they still want all-wheel drive.
I think the Bolt was the right place to go mainstream at that price, with that range and reasonable performance. I think they really hit it mostly out of the park, if that's possible. Could they have done a Model S fighter as well? Yeah, they could have, and I wouldn't think it'd be a bad idea for them to come up with one in those, 20 models that they say they have coming by 2023. But they've got to make sure if they do, they get it right. The ELR, even if the Chevy Volt with a V had not been there to begin with, still wouldn't have been a success. It wasn't good enough. That big tunnel in the middle, the range still wasn't quite good enough in electric mode. The performance definitely wasn't there. It had a great interior. That was probably one of the best interiors a Cadillac has done. So if the drivetrain had been a Cadillac-level drivetrain, then the answer would have been yes. It should have been an ELR first and then a Chevy Volt after. Mm.
Could be. I think sales wouldn't change a whole lot. Just look at the overall green car segment. It's still 3%, a little over 3% of the market. And there's more hybrids coming, more plug-ins coming, more BEVs coming, and all it's done is sliced up the market more thinly.
Except the study that I read today, John, says it's going to be big news coming forward.
I know everyone's predicting that EVs are going to take over the market.
Well, I find particularly interesting, I'm talking about a study that was released to the media today by the Boston Consulting Group. And here's the shocker. They're saying that by 2030, a full 50% of the U.S. market will consist of electrified vehicles. Now, that ranges from micro-hybrids, the 48-volt systems.
We all knew that hybrids. Before they said that. Right.
Right. And
but what do they say, BEV?
BEV,
it's only 50.
BEV, yeah. 20%. That's a big number. And by the way, their numbers are based on some conservative assumptions on battery cost and on fuel costs. If I would tend to think that their number on fuel oil is low and that their price for where batteries are going is high.
So that would be about 3.5 million vehicles a year that are BEVs,
yeah,
by 2030.
Now, what's interesting is there's another assumption baked into
that. And that's just the U.S., right?
Yeah. The whole world is about 50%, but the mix varies. So, for example, China will also be heavy BEV and a lot more plug-ins than we are. Japan will be primarily micro and conventional hybrids, and it has a lot to do with price for electricity and also how much mileage you drive, which determines what sort of payback you get. What I found very interesting, though, was a full half of the BEV, the pure battery electric vehicles, they estimate will go into ride-sharing fleets, Lyft, Uber, Get, whoever, and will be fully driverless. And it makes sense if you think about it. If you assume driverless technology is coming, those cars are going to log a lot of miles, 50, 100, 150,000 miles a year. And when you're getting up into the that sort of mileage, the savings on energy and on maintenance of a fully electric vehicle can be substantial. That's where they can make a lot of extra money.
Yeah, but so, let's see, 3.5 million vehicles, that would be what, 14 assembly plants worth of production churning out battery electrics in the next 13 years.
Yeah.
Unless it's in Fremont, California, and there'd be much more.
Yeah, but 500,000 in one plant, right. I'll believe it when I see it. Look, I have no question in my mind the industry is going to go, the market, that's the more important thing.
Yeah.
The market is going to go full electric at some point. Electrics are so quiet, they're so smooth. You know, no vibrations, instant
response.
They
can be fast. They can be cheap,
right,
to maintain.
But, boy,
at what point is that,
years?
What point is that going to be, John? Are we going to be talking about that, or will our avatars be doing that?
It'll be the avatar. Okay, let's move on. Ray Mitrowitz. Boy, I butchered your name there, Ray, but excuse me. What cars are you guys most excited to see at L.A. and Detroit soon? Gary, let's talk with you.
I haven't said anything. What am I most excited to see at L.A. and Detroit? I haven't really thought about that.
Okay, Jake?
The L.A. show, I'm excited to see the Jeep Wrangler in person. We just saw three photos
true.
Of it. We've been waiting a long time to see a Wrangler, a new Wrangler.
Right.
It's sort of a real iconic vehicle for Jeep, right? And this one looks like it's kept what we love about the Jeep, but advanced it. So I'm really excited to go and get to poke around that in person.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Any other cars you can think of, Paul?
Well, you know, it keeps going back and forth on whether we'll see the Supra there or not. If we
Toyota
do,
Supra?
Yeah. If we do, that's going to be a fun vehicle.
This would be LA?
Yeah.
I know.
I'm not sure we're going to there or Detroit.
I know Toyota's got big reveals at both.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that Detroit is going to be, well, I don't know, we're just guessing, right? My guess is it's going to be something more environmental than performance. But maybe I got
but
that
LA get, yeah, L.A. sometimes goes that direction. It's hard to tell with the L.A. show.
Right.
Last year wasn't very green, and it normally is.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'll also be curious to see how well they handle their automobility conference, which of course opens the day before the regular press preview. Last year was as boring as guano, the year before it had a lot of very interesting technologies to bring out. Last year, if you missed it, who cared?
Isn't Ram going to show the new Ram pickup in Detroit?
Right. In Detroit, yeah.
Detroit.
And now you've about exhausted my knowledge of what's coming.
I think those two, the Jeep and the Ram, I think are going to be really big debuts. For FCA, they're moneymakers and they sell a lot.
Wrangler's going to be essential. And the Chinese are going to want to know what they're going to be buying.
Yeah. Look, Jeep is starting to, you know, they got the pickup coming. They got the Grand Cherokee or Grand Wagoneer coming.
They got the pickup coming, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the pickup's going to be very interesting. I mean, do you guys think it will be more than the Flash? Will it be a major product, or will it just be sort of a quirky niche offering from Jeep?
I think with the love people have for Jeep and Wrangler, I think it will. When you see the number of people who spend quite a lot of money in the aftermarket to make Wrangler pickup trucks, I can see that succeeding. I think people just love the Jeep brand, right, and love Wrangler, and whether they actually do it or not, liking to think that they can go off through the desert and through mud and trails. And
I think what we've learned is that every brand's got to fight for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at JLR's, Jaguar Land Rover's strategy, Jaguar was going to do cars, Land Rover was going to do SUVs, and that was how it worked. And then Jaguar realized we're getting our teeth kicked in. We got to come out with SUVs. And boom, their sales took off, and it didn't hurt Land Rover. Hmm. So, you know, here's the argument that's been Ram is trucks and Jeep is Jeeps. And, you know, Jeep doesn't need a truck. Well, yeah, it does.
They do.
And I think it'll do just fine.
I think so, too.
Jeep sales down 11% so far this year.
So far this year, but remember, this
was a lot of stuff out of production and people waiting for the new Wrangler.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, what were the Compass numbers? They were not too bad, right?
Well, the Compass.
The new Compass.
For.
It's down substantially.
18 for the year, up 81% for the month of October. Yeah, so the new one is.
But what was their actual numbers? How many did they sell?
11,207.
That's not a bad number.
No.
11,000 and you're just getting going? That's a good number.
And it's nice.
It's good.
It's a good vehicle.
I don't like the engine, but other than that.
Yeah, it's not a great engine.
A minor detail.
Yeah.
It's a great car, but I sure as hell don't like driving.
But as far as I know, they'll address that. But the whole vehicle itself comes together very nicely.
Yeah.
Have you driven?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really nice. And you're looking at the point where there's a Jeep for everyone, right? In every size and price range, there's a model for whichever one you want.
And not the old confusion of the Compass and Patriot either.
Right, combined those into one model, which is a really nice improved model, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, one last viewer question, then we'll get into some of our topics too. So John Krugerud says, will sound systems be important in a Level 5 self-driving car? A tablet and some good headphones will be good to go if I don't have to pay attention to the road. He's got a good point. You know, if all you're going to be doing is working on your tablet while the car does its driving, do you need a killer sound system?
Well, part of the question is, who's Level 5 car? Are you going to be driving in one that you ordered up from Lyft, or is it going to be one that you pay for?
Good question.
I would expect, certainly with the mobiles, you know, the ride-sharing systems, they're going to load that car up with screens and audio, and if there's competition, it will be to make the interior and environment as cool as you want it to be. And what's going to happen is you are going to show up, or when the vehicle shows up, you'll walk out with whatever your smart device is, whether it's a smartphone or a pad or whatever, and it's going to automatically sync, and all that stuff will give you, it'll already be set up for the temperature you want, it'll play the audio you want, it'll put on multiple screens of different services you want, plus, of course, ads that they'll be putting in there to make money on.
Yeah. Speaking of autonomy, Gary, one of the things you wanted to talk about was Waymo.
They
made a big announcement this week.
I mean, so this week they basically brought journalists out to California to their proving ground, and they've basically been a company that's been somewhat silent. But John Krafcak got out there and said to one and all, you know, look, this is our vehicle, and this is what it can do. Why now? Are they feeling the pressure from, I don't know, Ford or General Motors?
I hope so. They should be. You've got Delphi, which split itself into two. The old Delphi name goes with the old metal bending stuff, the powertrain side. The new side, which is, interestingly enough, what they say will be the heart of the corporation going forward, is being renamed Aptiv. And that is going to be focusing heavily on electronic systems, including autonomous and driverless. You've got Continental. You've got how many others out
there? But I'll say this. I think Waymo is way out in front of all the other suppliers.
You know,
way out.
Okay,
in
are
front.
They? Okay, let's.
Are they,
let's,
John?
Are they going to be a supplier?
That's the question.
Okay, right? What do you think?
Probably. I think you provide software and hardware and give it to people. Because as Tesla is teaching us, building cars is hard, and it's really tough to go into the making cars business.
So do you think that it would be? So remember when Ford Sync came out and it was powered by Microsoft? People seem to forget that now, but I mean, that's where it all came from. Would it be? So now I have a Chevy Malibu powered by Waymo.
No, I don't think the public is going to care about that. But we are going to evolve from my car is faster than your car to my car is more autonomous than your car. My car can drive across the field to the tailgate party at the football game. Your car can't do that. And so, yeah, I think that whoever gets to the market first with a truly autonomous level 4, level 5 car.
And that's what Krafcik says.
And that's what he's got.
He's saying it's level 3, forget about it.
Oh, yeah. Ford has said the same thing.
And they, by the way, have been hinting at going right up to 4 and 5 for a while. I did not find that new. Krafcik has said that in a couple scrums that I've been
this
in for
not,
a while.
Yeah, basically, right. So for those who don't know, so basically level 4 is it's autonomous within a geofenced area it drives itself.
It is capable of driverless, fully driverless in geo and weather-fenced conditions.
And level 5 is just
anywhere.
Right. And level 3 is that it has capability, but the driver has to be capable of taking back control within some period of time.
See, the key thing I think that what my takeaway from the Waymo thing was Krafcik said autonomy is going to be here way sooner than most people realize.
Yeah.
Way sooner to me means before 2020.
So this would be before all those electric vehicles are going to be out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But so your question's the most important one. What is their business strategy? Are they going to partner up with somebody? Or are they just going to become a supplier? Say, hey, any OEM that wants to buy it, we're ready to sell.
See, the thing that I wonder about is that, okay, how does Google make its money?
Selling advertising.
Ads. Right. So, I mean, that's their whole business model. We think of them, oh, they just give us all that free information when we Google things, right? But no, they're selling ads. So why would they leave what has proven to be a tremendously successful model and just basically say, okay, Mr. Automaker, I'm going to sell you this package of hardware and software, and that's it.
Because I think you got to stand back and look at it. It's more than advertising. Google is the master at monetizing data. And autonomous cars are going to generate more data than anything, more than your phone, your tablet, your current car, whatever. And they're just rubbing their hands in glee, I think, of saying, if we sell the system, we have first crack at the data. And I think there's going to be huge negotiations going on between OEMs who are buying versus OEMs who are doing everything in-house, like GM and Ford and Toyota and others are. And look, you know, McKinsey came out with a study that says monetizing car data will be a market anywhere from $450 billion to $750 billion by 2030.
Approaching the size of the auto industry today.
Well, no, it's not quite.
That's
but
a trillion-dollar industry.
Well, it's a multi-trillion-dollar industry. But the point
is that
I'm talking globally. Yeah. I want to say the global automaker's revenue is about $2.5 trillion, something
globally.
Like that.
Yeah.
But here is a market that does not exist at all for all practical purposes, going to potentially, let's call it close to a trillion in the next 15 years or so. So that's a huge amount of money, and I think that's what Google has got its eyes on, and they've got to get automakers buying their system because the big guys, GM, Ford, Toyota, probably Mercedes and others are going, no, we're going to do this all in-house.
Well, here, let me throw something at you, and this is where it gets really difficult to do any sort of prediction right now. What will the model be for 2030? In other words, when we, toddling along on our canes, want to get
Jake's in. Not going to be on a cane. He's a young dude.
Yeah.
When he's wheeling us along in our wheelchair, what vehicle will he put us in? And for one thing, we talked earlier about the rise of car sharing. What will car sharing mean to the business? If I pull out my phone and I just go, send me, I may pick large, larger, luxurious, cheap, and so on. But will I be pressing the button to say, bring me the Ford or the Volvo or the Mercedes or so on? And there's a good argument that other than maybe size and class, I won't care the brand that pulls up. So
the brand of car.
Brand of service
right. That brings the car.
No, so now Uber does right now,
yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So you want a black car, get a black car. You want a...
That matters too.
But
yeah,
right now, that's only a couple percent of total rides. Some people are talking about one-third of the miles that people will clock by 2030 in the United States will be in one of those rideshare vehicles. So at that point, one has to say, who has the power in the business? It will be going forward over the next 10 years, you're going to see three different groups battling for dominance. The ride-sharing companies, the OEs who will manufacture, they'll bend metal, and the technology firms. And Waymo wants to make sure that they are in the game and are not just a supplier that just, you say, let's see, on this plot of products, I'm going to load up with the Continental technology. And next time I'll go with Waymo. Next time I'll go with Delphi or whoever. They want to be the go-to. And it may be that in 10 years or 15 years from now, the biggest player in the business is going to be known as Uber, Lyft, Get, or some other entity to come along. And the OEs won't be much more than sheet metal suppliers.
Could be. It could absolutely happen. And that's why, you know, they're all jumping in right now to make sure that they're players.
Exactly.
And all three, in the tech, in the manufacturing, in the ride service.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we shall see.
And I want to mention, remember we had Larry Dominique from Peugeot on the show?
I know where you're going with this.
So, all right, so who has seen Blade Runner 2049?
I have not.
Not yet.
No, not yet.
Yeah.
All right.
So tell us why you're bringing
this up. So Ryan Gosling, who is the main character in this one, you know, Harrison Ford's role is very small. Ryan Gosling's playing the cop in L.A. in 2049, and his flying car is a Peugeot.
Oh.
So I contacted Larry, and I told him, I said, gee, Larry, you've become successful, but you've become successful in 2049, in the future. So as you can see, there on the back of that vehicle,
Peugeot.
It says Peugeot.
Wow.
And it was very surprising to see that. And
did Larry know about this?
Yeah, apparently he did, but he had nothing to do with it. I mean, he was
who? This was purely.
Come on.
This was not a placement. This was.
Well, I'm sure it was, but I don't think Larry was. I mean, because he came to the, he was named.
Oh yeah. To just this year.
Yeah. So
and
so,
this movie's been in the works.
Before
he got here.
But isn't it interesting that it's Peugeot in L.A. in 2049? And, you know, we're talking about all this car sharing and ride sharing, and Larry's first product to this country is that...
The app. The
right?
ride sharing app.
The ride sharing app that aggregates all of this stuff, right? And so you get this, and so someday you may find yourself in the back of
a Peugeot
cop car. Yeah. Put your head down.
Bang your head. Remember, you're supposed to bang your head of criminals now?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay, let's wrap it up. Paul Eisenstein, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Jake, been great having you here representing Motor One. And Gary, always good to be sitting next to you here. And let's do it again next week.
Okay.
And, of course, got to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.